Welcome to the Bicycle Media Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the health of the cycling industry.
Not a lot of people had that tone that just said, ride whatever bike you want to ride.
There's a couple of things about building a custom bike.
What these e-bikes can do.
It's quite hard for them to train when they don't know what they're training for.
I started to demystify things.
But if you don't have the right staff, that's game over.
You're not selling at that point, you're educating.
Big shout out to the folks at Roasty for keeping the podcast caffeinated. Again, for orders over $40, they're going to ship free in Canada. Deliveries within the Edmonton area are now happening weekdays. And the cafe's open for a little bit as well. So big thanks to guys at Roasty. Check them out, roasty.ca. Back with an episode that I'm really excited about. This is with Lael Wilcox, ultra endurance bike racer. And I first found out about Lael through some documentaries that are out there on YouTube. And what really struck me is her sort of humble nature. She's on some very long races. I mean, 4K if you're going coast to coast, Banff to New Mexico. It's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating sport. What I really liked about it, talking to her, and she'll talk a little bit more about it, is just the level playing field between male and female athletes. And much like another guest that we have coming up and ones that we spoke to in the past, the cycling career started a bit late, but an athletic lifestyle meant that Lael and many others have had early success, which I think is awesome. So I'll let Lael go into all of that, but just, I think, something really cool about sort of a harder sport to televise, ultra endurance cycling, but it's huge and growing through these documentaries. So I really, really dig this episode. Great to reach out to her in Alaska in between race season. And here it is, my episode with Lael Wilcox. Maybe to start off by giving our listeners a sense of your cycling background and how it's led to your ultra endurance racing career, you know, with cycling all the way in your life, and how did the bike enter your life to where it is now?
Sure. Yeah, I actually didn't really start riding until I was 20. And that was just, I got a job at a brewery, and I before that I used to just walk everywhere. But the brewery was 4 miles away, so I got a bike just to kind of speed up my trips. And it was just going to and from work. And then within a few months, I was just kind of riding all over town. This was in Tacoma, Washington in, 2006 or so. And then I just kind of started getting these ideas. I was like, my sister was living in Seattle. That was 45 miles away. And I thought, oh, what if I just rode to go visit her? And at this time, I just had a fixed gear bike. But it was like my first new bike. It was like $500. I was like, whoa, this is the nicest bike ever. You know, and then I kind of just was clueless. I didn't have a smartphone, so I just printed out a stack of directions to get there, and then turn by turn followed it. It took me all day. I'd never gone so far. And kind of during that ride, I was like, wow, if you could bike from one city to another, you could bike across the country. And I'd never really heard of bike touring, but I was like, what a cool thing to do. You just travel the country, see everything along the way, not really have a plan of where I'm going to sleep every night, but just know that I'll probably ride about 50 miles a day and then piece that together. So then 3 months later, I had graduated college. I wanted to leave right away, but I didn't have any money. So I worked in a restaurant, saved money, and then took off on my first bike trip. And that was 2008. And then since that time, for the next 7 years or so, I was just doing this pattern of working to save money for half the year and then riding for the other half the year. And it first started with trips around the U.S., then going into Mexico, then traveling in Europe, and then South Africa, the Middle East. I was like, anywhere, you know, I kind of got like a curiosity for. I was like, what's it like there? And then, you know, what would it be like to ride through? And it started on road, started road touring, and then switched to more dirt because I felt like that took me to more adventurous places. And then it was really during one of these trips, I was traveling through the Middle East, traveling through Israel. And I realized I was going to be there when they hosted this 850-mile mountain bike race. And I was like, well, I'm already riding this area. You know, I love this region. What would it be like to actually race against other people and see what I could do? And it's all self-supported. So you carry what you need along the way, decide where you're going to sleep, what you're going to eat, and kind of make your own plan. And everybody starts together, and whoever gets to the finish first wins. And that's the only thing. You just can't have any help. So I I entered the race. I was the only woman. I think there were like 40 guys, and I just had my travel bike, platform pedals, you know, cotton t-shirt. They all thought I was a huge joke. But I was like, whatever, you know, who cares how I do? I just want to ride and see how it goes. And then we're riding along the first day, and, you know, these guys are just crushing me in the beginning. I think I was like mid pack. 'Cause I was like, well, I'm just going to ride as hard as I can. And then, you know, over time, I just kept going into the night. I rode until like 3 a.m. And at the end of the first night, I was like 25 miles ahead of the guy in second place. But I didn't even know, because they had just like pulled off to sleep, pulled off to eat. You know, everybody had stopped and I just kept going. And then I pulled off on the side of the road, slept for 3 hours, woke up and then started riding again. You know, and then at this point, I'm like way in the lead. And all these guys are like, how is this happening? You know, 'cause they're like checking, we all have spot trackers to show our locations. And then they wake up and they check the map and they're like, she's ahead of all of us. You know, like, how did that even happen? And it's like, well, you just keep going. And that's how it happened. So, that was my first experience. And, I just loved it. I was like, this is so exciting. You get to see so much, you see everything all day and all night, and kind of push your limits, see what you can do. It's an adventure along the way. And during this ride, it was like kind of a test for me. I was like, if I like this, I'm going to go back to the US and I want to race the Tour Divide. But I had like kind of mapped it out where I was like, okay, if I go back to Anchorage right now, right after this trip in Israel, I'll have a week to get a race bike together. Then I can ride from Alaska 2,100 miles down to Banff, take a week off, and then race the Tour Divide. And it was like my grand plan to like, I had never ridden or driven or gone from Alaska through Canada, and that's where I'm from. So I was like, I want to see my country. That's the way I'm going to get to the start. And then I'll rest for a week and then I'll do this big race and just see how it goes. So that was kind of the next thing I did, which was so, so fun. You know, it was so exciting.
So was any kind of a sport in your life up to then? Because I think and I've heard this before, where folks have cycling as a commuting portion of their life. It's not maybe, you know, they didn't start off with a BMX club when they could barely, you know, walk or whatever, but were you doing anything up to then? And because I mean, what you're doing, the feats of human capability that you're doing, I mean, you started at age 20, but there you are in your first event kicking butt.
Oh man, I had been a long distance runner. So I think I always just thought of stuff in like distance. So like I started running the end of high school. And then right after I graduated, I ran a marathon. And I was like, you know, it's like, well, if I could go 5K, could I go, you know, 20K? Could I push that farther? And so I think I always wanted to just like kind of go farther, longer distance. But then when I got into cycling, I saw it really only as a vehicle. I was like, okay, this is a great way to travel. It's good transportation. It's a way that you can carry gear easily, because you can't really run with a bunch of stuff. But I never really saw it as a sport until I started doing this racing and then realized, wow, I can actually like engage in this like as a sport, kind of push my physical limits, try to ride faster. You know, it's not just a way to get around. So that transitioned for me, and it actually made the riding so much more fun too. It's like if you look at it as a vehicle, it's a great vehicle, but you get kind of run down of, oh, I'm just kind of slogging along instead of riding with more heart, you know, picking up the pace or kind of feeling more alive about it. I guess that took me a long time to kind of figure that piece out. I guess 7 years really, you know, and I can't believe I stuck with it, because there are so many moments where I was like, I just want to be running. I just wanted to throw my bike off a cliff. I was like, I'm so tired of this thing, but now I love it. You know, it's like everything kind of changed. Now I have that same kind of running feeling on the bike, you know, but it took me a long time to switch, mix it up.
Totally. And in doing research for the interview, obviously I watched, I Just Want to Ride, I'm Not Stopping. There was even sort of a Q&A you did where folks asked, you know, what would you be doing if you weren't racing? And again, time and time again, you reference the fact that you just love being on the bike. And I certainly don't want to spoil the outcomes or some of those stories within the films, but there were times where maybe a goal you were trying to achieve didn't, maybe get to where it needed to be, but yet you still had this wonderful thing of like, hey, if I'm on a bike and I'm pedaling, that's a great day.
Well, it's like, what else would I want to be doing? You know, I mean, the records can go away, the results can go away, but you still get to be out there like in nature. That's the real like win of it, the experience, you know, that feeling. And it's like, you don't have to race to get that feeling. In fact, maybe it's better if you don't. You're just out there riding, kind of on your own schedule, having your own adventure.
Course records, though, can we talk a little bit about those? And what I liked following, you know, your journey and learning a little bit more about ultra endurance sports is that it's the first time that I really see, you know, men and women competing together. When we look at contact or, you know, those combat sports, it's not often pieced together, but I think it's very special. But can you talk about setting records, setting course records, and then competing against your male counterparts?
Yeah, I think, you know, for this ultra distance athletics, both running and riding, the longer the distance, the more it's like a level playing field for men and women. So, I think ultimately it'll become that there don't have to be two separate categories, the men's record, women's record. At this point, not that many women are competing, but as that changes, you know, you'll see more women outright winning, outright setting records. And that's something that I've pushed for myself, just because it you have to prove that it's possible for people to believe it. So like my biggest win probably was the Trans Am in 2016. It's a 4,300 mile race, road race across the U.S. And I wasn't a road rider, but I entered this race and I had all these goals. I was going to win the race and I was going to break the overall record. And I get, you know, the overall record at that time was 17 and a half days or 17 days, 20 hours, something like that. And I get like 5 days into this race. I'm averaging, you know, at this point, probably 230 miles a day. And I was just like, I'm dying out here. is so much harder than I thought it was going to be. And it was a heat wave and it was just so hot. But I was still like, well, I'm not a good road rider, but I have to learn. You know, I have to like get better as this as I go, because I'm not coming back to do this again. It's too hard, but I want to win right now. You know, and I was like, I don't know about that record, because of the record I needed to average 250 miles a day. And I was like, I don't know, but I'm just going to keep day after day working as hard as I can, making as much distance as I can, sleeping about 5 hours a night. And so I worked at this. I became a better road rider and I was just like, you know, grinding away, and I was gaining on people. So near the halfway point, I was, I think, in about third place. And I'm just like moving and moving. I'm like, the guy in first place is, you know, first 200 miles ahead of me, and then 150, and then 80, and then close to the finish. I'm like, the last three nights I slept a total of 6 hours. So I was like on the hunt for this guy. I was like, I didn't know if I was going to get him, but I was like, I have to try. You know, I'm like 16 days into this race. And I caught him the final night. I caught him at like 3 a.m. in rural Virginia. And then we had 130 miles to go, I think. And I just started sprinting like it was the last, you know, sprint to the race. But I was like, this is my chance to get him. And I ended up beating him. You know, he finished like 2 hours after me. And it was just, you know, you do everything you can to win. You never know if it's going to happen. There's so many factors. I mean, along the way, it's like, I broke my seat post. I had to get that fixed. It's like, you have mechanicals, you have physical issues, you get flat tires. And that's part of self-supported racing, is that you have to fix all that stuff. And yeah, it's frustrating, but it's also like kind of a cool element that you're really doing it on your own. And so that was, you know, and then I outright won this race and people were just totally shocked. A woman won the race. I was, you know, the first woman to win that race. First American. I think it was the third edition. I was only 8 hours slower than the record by the end of it. And so, I mean, it's like, you don't know, you know, what you're capable of doing until you do it. Nobody does. So that's kind of like the moral of that story, is like, I wasn't the best road rider, but I was determined. I got better. You know, you have to make sacrifices, and then you also have to have decent conditions. And But it's exciting just to experience that and then also see what you can do. So the last year, another woman won a race across Europe, a woman's run a race across Australia, you know, so it's like the more evidence that it's possible that women can win. And I, you know, ultimately don't think that men have traits, natural traits that are better. They're just different for ultra distance. It's like everybody has to eat, sleep, keep moving, have their bodies hold up. So it doesn't matter who's the most physically powerful for something that takes 2 weeks. There are just so many other factors.
Yeah, and you touched on it right from the first race where you passed somebody who was a group of males that were sleeping. And that comes up a lot. When we start to, you know, look at all the film regarding your events and your races, it shows up that you are willing to ride through the night. I think on the I'm not stopping in that regard. I think it was the 4 days or whatnot. You were maybe 9.5 hours asleep, I think it was, throughout those 4 days.
So it's horrible.
And I want to talk about a few things now. So nutrition, mechanicals, and then that deprivation. Because you referenced it, let's start with mechanicals. You know, you're in charge of your bike in between those stops. Did you have to get up to speed on a few things? And what's the worst mechanical you've ever had to take care of yourself somewhere remotely?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, I'm really not a good mechanic. Really bad. You know, which is a weakness. It's like it would be very helpful to be better, but, you know, that's not my strength. But I mean, the main thing is starting with a really good working bike in the first place. And most of the time you don't have that many problems. If the bike is strong and solid and taken care of, then really it's a lot of it is just making sure you have things to fix your tires, you know, keep air in your tires, keeps you rolling. Because a lot of other parts of the bike, it's like they might not function perfectly, but they'll still keep working as you go. So I have like a pretty minimal repair kit that I bring. And a lot of that is just for tires. There's also quick links for my chain. There's a spare derailleur hanger, but just little pieces. It fits into a tiny little pouch. And then I also have a pump. The worst mechanical for me. So I was doing this race called the French Divide. It's 1400 miles across France, mountain bike. And the beginning of the race, we all start as big group and, they're like, everybody's excited. You know, people are kind of riding crazy because they're nervous. And I get to about the mile 70 of the race first afternoon and I'm riding. And then there's a quick turn and I make this turn and this young guy, his first race crashes into me and, totally ruins my rear wheel. Like it's totally out of shape. It won't clear the frame at first. I was just like, I pick up my bike and it won't roll. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, and then part of this racing is that this race, I started on a Sunday and you can't have anybody come help you and you can't get replacement parts. Like if you need a new part, you have to ride to a bike shop and see if they have it and try to fix it there because that's a service that's available for all the racers. But it's a Sunday in France. I start like looking up, you know, where's the nearest bike shop. Nothing was going to open till Tuesday. I was like, oh, okay. What am I supposed to do between now and then? So then I go back to my bike. This wheel is like totally crooked. This young guy who crashed into me, his bike's totally fine, but he stays to try to help me fix my bike. And we're like, you know, trying to true the wheel with a spoke wrench, that's doing very little. We take the wheel out of the frame and start smashing it into the sidewalk to try to straighten out the rim. You know, other racers come up, they're like, what's going on? And start giving us advice. Oh, maybe you should get a zip tie and put that on your frame. You know, like just weird stuff. But we got it, like, we like smashed it enough that it was just super wobbly, but it still cleared the frame. And then I rode the next, you know, over 1300 miles with a bad wheel. And I just felt it like shimmy behind me the whole time. I mean, at first I was like worried that it wasn't going to last, but it did. But then it's just like this kind of shake, you know, for the next 9 days. Oh, it was horrible. God. But, you know, it's like, well, I'm not going to quit just because my wheel's wonky. but it was not ideal.
Well, and we'll put links in the show notes to your 2019, the specialized epic hardtail that you had. But when I listen to that story of a wobbly bike for 9 days, it's just like, I curse when I pull out a shopping cart and get halfway to buying groceries. I can't imagine riding the bike for that long.
Yeah, kind of like that, but over cobblestones.
Yeah. Holy, already with cobblestones plus a wobbly bike. Well, I've now watched the film I Just Want to Ride twice, once by myself, once with my daughter. To show her the feats of what women can do. I take her to university women's hockey games, and I just try and inspire her. And she loves French fries. You love French fries. And I want to talk about a scene. I certainly don't want to ruin anything. I want to talk about nutrition because I'll always remember you stuffing a bag full of French fries and just dumping salt into the bag on your top tube. Can you talk a little bit about nutrition? I can't imagine that you kind of eat the same way when you're on the other half of the year, but does nutrition require a strategy when you're a couple miles out and you know it's coming up, and when you get into this store, especially if somebody's on your tail or another rider enters a convenience store when you do? But what's the vibe with nutrition for you?
Yeah, I guess that's the thing, is it's so self-supported race. You have to get your own food, water, everything. And so for me, it's like I want to spend the least amount of time off my bike. So I eat everything on the bike. And then it's like, well, what's portable? What's appetizing? You know, it's like a race that takes 2 weeks. You don't want to just eat Clif bars or energy food. It just gets old. You know, it doesn't, yeah. It's too sweet. It just doesn't taste right. So then I start relying more on real food. But then it's like, you know, I take like 3 cheeseburgers to go for the next day. But then, you know, once, like 12 hours later, these are also not appetizing, but you know what? You just eat them anyway. So it's like anything, you know, that seems like portable or that you can eat on the bike. And then, you know, if you're mostly shopping at gas stations, the options are pretty slim. I drink a lot of milk. I mean, the best kind of energy food is ice cream, but you just can't carry it. You know, it's like it just melts. So that's not going to work. So then it's like, well, what do you bring? So yeah, French fries, but then when they're cold, not good. You know, one of the best is pizza, because it's still good cold. You know, old slices of pizza, that's never bad. So if I can find that, I'm like, ooh, that's good. Or in France, it was the best because they had all the bakeries, you know? So that was like, I'd eat like 10 croissants a day.
Yeah,
the other element of it is that you just eat a ridiculous amount of food. It's like just so much food. And then you're like, at some point you're like, I don't want to eat this, but you have to. It's like, you just have to keep going. So I guess that's just another wacky part of the racing. It's like an eating competition, you know?
Well, I do recall half and half creamer out of a 1 liter jug.
Oh, horrible. Oh, that was bad. They didn't have milk, so I just got half and half. And then, you know, for the next hour, I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to keep it down. It was so gross.
Well, I think that's a great segue into just, you know, deprivation. And what I love about endurance sports is it shows us what we are capable of. And for those that are you guys that are doing these events and being showcased through these films, you are, of course, then you become these beacons of light of what humans can achieve. And for those of us that are maybe just simply stuck in traffic to go work a day job at a cubicle, it now becomes, look, if somebody can ride for, you know, 5 days straight on 9.5 hours of sleep, or if somebody can say, I'm going to leave my hometown in Anchorage and just, you know, casually ride my bike to Banff to start a race, then I can get through this workday. But describe that idea of, you know, riding through the night, or maybe not having packed enough food. You know, there's scenes where you're pushing a bike up, you know, muddy terrain, and maybe the record is now past you or that sort of thing. So how do you manage those moments of just sheer exhaustion? And because there's a mental skill that I think you probably are utilizing, whether you have studied sports psych or not. I mean, it's talk about, you know, that whole push of the human body.
I mean, the main thing is, it's like, for the most part, I just really want to be out there. There's so much beauty to see. And, you get so many ideas when you're physically working and kind of traveling through a space, and that's so exciting. And then, of course, there are going to be hard hours, too, where you're physically in pain or you're just so tired, you know, you don't feel great. But kind of in those times, it's like, at this point, I know they'll pass, you know, and it probably won't even be that long, maybe an hour, and then I'll feel better. I'll things will change. And I guess that's part of the exciting part of these races is that it does change. It's like you feel like something's impossible. You feel like you can't keep going. And then you do, maybe not at your full potential, but you keep moving forward. And then an hour later, you feel better and you ride faster. And, so you go through these kind of waves of experience and emotions. And I love kind of following that. And then I guess another part of it is like knowing that it won't last forever either. You know, so it's like I could feel kind of low and then an hour later feel great. And then usually whenever I'm like coming close to the finish line, I feel like I'm flying. You know, you have so many reserves to kind of get yourself across the line. And then once you cross the line, you're just totally dead. So it's like kind of this pairing of physical body versus like mental energy. And I guess what helps me perform the best is just trying to stay as positive as possible. Cause you have all this self doubt, like, why am I doing this? So I'm not capable of this. And if you kind of just don't focus on that, don't give it power, then you do better, you know, cause like driving yourself into a negative hole is just going to make you ride slower, make you feel worse. So, focusing on the good parts or just thinking about persevering until you feel better again. That's life itself. But that's definitely what it's like on a bike too. And then you have these great moments where the sun actually finally comes up or you see wild animals or you see something special in that moment that you never would have seen otherwise. You wouldn't have seen if you were out there in the middle of the night riding through it. So, I like that, you know, it's so much, so many unexpected experiences. It's really cool.
That's a great tie into my next question, because I know, yourself and, Kat Rodriguez, put together the Anchorage Grit or, Girls Riding Into Tomorrow 3-day event. You know, there's a lead up to it. These girls are learning things, but you're also mentoring them through this. I think that is so special and speaks to your character and how you're, you know, passing the olive branch down. You're probably showing these young ladies that, look, you can achieve anything and let's do something crazy awesome. You know, let's talk about bike maintenance and first aid and let's just go into the bush and show you that you can do anything. What's that feeling like from the start to the end of something so special like that?
Oh, it's so inspiring for me. So the GRIT program, this would have been the fourth year. We had to postpone for coronavirus, but we start off and we do a 6-week mentorship program with 12 and 13-year-old girls. And in the beginning, they've never ridden more than 5 miles. And then by the end, we build up to a 60-mile, 3-day adventure ride from their school in East Anchorage out to the wilderness. And at first, you know, it's like they're walking all the hills, they feel like they're dying, but we ride together 3 days a week and they kind of build, you know, their time on the bike, but then also their confidence of what they can do. And then at the end, we go for this big challenge ride and it's really hard for them. Hardest thing they've physically done, but they do it and they're so excited and proud. And they stay at these cool cabins, you know, out in nature and then they come back the next year as student mentors. And so then they can be with the new girls and they can, you know, the new girls are like, oh, that's so hard. I can't do it. So they can kind of explain, you know, how you can build up to it and what it's like and kind of be there. Cause I mean, it's having kids are always the most inspired and motivated and trusting of kids that are close to their age. You know, those are the best role models for them. Those are what they want to build up to. And then they're like, oh, if this girl could do it, I could do it too. You know? And so for me to see that year after year, them coming back and kind of completing this program and finishing with the adventure ride, it's so cool to see, you know, it's so cool to see them improve so much over 6 weeks. That's really not a lot of time, but kids can, no. are capable of so much, you know? So it's kind of about learning, like learning about taking on a challenge and building up to it and accomplishing it. And they don't have to, you know, they don't have to grow into ultra endurance bike racers, but just that, that confidence that they could do something on their own, be outside, learn new skills, and also have fun. You know, it doesn't have to be serious all the time. It's just a way to be active and outside.
Awesome. That's great. Just a couple more questions before we release you to the Alaskan wilderness. You know, folks have come to know you. I mean, you know, I Just Want to Ride, for instance, has had over 600,000 views. So, you know, probably a household name for many. And I always ask this of individuals, if you yourself, Leo, were to walk into a bike shop and wanting to purchase a bike, maybe a platform that you haven't done, you figured one day, well, I'm going to try and ride track, or I want to, you know, get a time trial bike. How does the bike shop make you feel welcomed when you walk in? Because, I mean, you have a background in cycling. Yeah. So how does that feel? Because that's an important question. A lot for our listeners who are, of course, service managers, mechanics, bike shop owners. How do they make you feel welcomed and like, okay, this is where I want to invest on my next bike?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I guess the best thing is, you know, if you go to a shop and they're the ones asking the questions, what kind of riding do you want to do? You know, and then what are you looking for, and kind of guiding you through the process of getting the right bike? I guess that's the first thing. You know, second, it's great if shops create a culture around what they're doing. They host rides, or they host talks, or, you know, they have like things beyond just the equipment. It's like inspiration, or, you know, ideas, sharing ideas, encouraging people to ride. You know, that's definitely another component. And then I partner with a local shop here. It's the oldest shop in Alaska. And one thing I've done is just, you know, a lot of my friends, I've kind of asked them to come up to work at the shop, different women, because I feel like, you know, women are the minority in the bicycle industry at this point. And so if there are more women working at shops, maybe more women will feel welcomed in that space too. So, you know, that can help as well. I mean, it's not necessary. Guys can be totally sensitive as well, but it's just more of, you know, not making it so much about just the components, but what can they do for you as a rider? What's the experience? What are you trying to build towards with riding, instead of like, oh, this is superior to that for whatever reason? Well, there's such a broad spectrum of what's good, you know. Well, for like somebody who's less flexible and wants to ride the bike path, having an upright, solid bike, that might be the best. You know, it's like what's good for you could be so different for so many different people, but, you know, maybe not judging the equipment, but just providing solutions. That's kind of it, because that's the fortunate thing at this point. There are so many good bikes. You're probably not going to get on a bad one. You know, it might not be like correct for your application, and the fit might not be great, but, bikes just have gotten so good. Even, you know, for grit, we use these $500 entry-level mountain bikes. And I, you know, you look at this bike and it's like, oh, that's just a basic bike. That's nothing nice. But you see the girls react to them and their eyes just get huge. They've never had a new bike. I mean, this is like a amazing machine, you know? And then you think about that and it's like, well, $500 isn't that much, but I think what it can actually do, it can take you out to the woods, you know, it's like totally ready to go. So it's cool to kind of see the perspective of what bikes mean to different people. If you're riding it, it's a good bike.
My last question, a real short one. If you were being tasked from an advertising agency to put an inspiring message on just a mere bumper sticker to get people to take up ultra endurance cycling, you've got not a lot of words. What might you put on this bumper sticker for, you know, the Just Do It's of the world? How would you encourage people to just put in the time to ride and do what you're doing?
That's tough. It could be something like riding a bike is never a waste of time.
Beautiful. Done. We're going into production tomorrow with that. Thank you. How can folks stay in touch with you, follow you in terms of what you're doing, learn more about Grit? How can folks just kind of get in touch online?
Yeah, so they can find, you know, a video series on YouTube. They're all free. And more kind of constant updates, Instagram is probably the best. Yeah, that's probably about it.
Thank you so much for being my guest today. I'm so glad we caught up to you. And like I said, we'll release you to the Alaskan wilderness to enjoy the bike. And it's never a waste of time, right?
Yeah, great talking with you.
Big thanks to Lael for her time. Hope she's doing well. And I hope, you know, these events that she absolutely crushes come back into effect and she's able to continue to build that legacy. Up next is Ryan Atkinson, president and co-founder of Smart E-Tailing. We talked a lot about such platforms that they have of Buy Local Now, some of the marketing that they do for their bicycle retail clients, how e-commerce is benefiting bike shops in COVID. And as well, you know, we're talking a little bit about what makes the online shopping experience so important and how that follow-up is important and how fitting if there's, you know, curbside pickup or bike drop-off is maybe being missed, but just a good opportunity to build good customer lifetime value. And Ryan talks a little bit about that. He was also, you know, behind the wrench for early part of his career, over 20 years in the bike industry. So him and the team at Smart E-Tailing do amazing work marketing for bike shops, building websites. And again, they have that infrastructure from all of the you know, distributors and manufacturers. So really great interview. And again, if you're not familiar with Smart E-Tailing and you do own a bike shop or you're in the service department listening to this podcast, check them out. Links in the description. And I've been in on some of those calls where Giant Canada is speaking to retailers about just connecting their inventory and theirs. So really interesting stuff. And again, during COVID, bike sales went smash through the ceiling. A lot of times those purchases were made online. So some good conversation about what the website should have for you. Anyways, thanks again for tuning in. Big shout out to my folks at Roasty for keeping us caffeinated. Stay safe. Cheers for next time.